stay here as we are all the way through this morning with Casey. Casey, unfortunately, in hospital again this weekend, and Joanne doing a terrific job with us and helping. And so we're through the switch at 9, and we'll go straight through till noon. We did that on Saturday, basically. We threw the switch, starting with Dubai and with Nick Luck anchoring the coverage of the World Cup night, and another spectacular evening and another great year. And Nick and Scott Hazelton and Brittany Erton on hand and more. Nick joins us. Nick, well done.
Well, thank you, Steve. Thank you very much. And always lovely to talk to you. And I'd love to say I'm feeling fresh after the weekend's exertions, but I'm in recovery before the Grand National this week. It's a crazy time of year.
Well, and I'm glad you brought the Grand National up, because we're going to slip that in as well. But let's talk about the weekend. And, you know, you also had to do Luck on Sunday. You had to do your popular weekend recap show yesterday before flying. Let's take a look at the the evening. And I mean, what was the star moment for you?
I think in the round, the star moment in terms of setting us up for what could be for the remainder of the season was the Japanese filly Armandai.
Mm-hmm.
I think many people expected her to win by a long, long way. And as things stood, she won only by a length and a half. But she'd glided round as though she was in a different parish to the rest of her rivals. And I'm just not sure she did a right lot when she hit the front. She took a wide trip most of the race. The sectional showed it was a pretty smart performance. The final time confirmed that. And I've no doubt she's a filly right out of the top draw, and she's already proven herself as effective over a mile and a half as she is over a mile or a mile and an eighth the distance of Saturday night's race. So I thought she was the most exciting prospect on the evening in terms of moving forward to taking on the best that Europe has to offer in Europe potentially this season in the Judmont International at York and then in the Arc. And you've got this enticing prospect that the three best turf females in the world, whose name is not Winx, because we know that Winx is going to finish her career in Australia this year, but the three best turf females in the world, whose name is not Winx, arguably are Armandai, Sea of Class, and Enable. Of course, Newspaper of Record can join that list, but those three older fillies at the moment, if they were all to meet one another, that would be an unbelievable prospect, and that could yet happen this year. So I think for me that was the single most exciting moment of the night for that very reason.
And I completely agree, and I don't want to take away from Thunder Snow's individual accomplishment, and we have to talk about that and put it in context. But Almondai, who really what she accomplished last year, culminating with the Japan Cup victory, has got, I think it got people in this country excited, and then now to, pick up and go, and the suggestion was made that she wasn't even, she was far from 100% even to kick off the campaign.
Well, I think the beauty of any horse that can campaign successfully internationally is that they have to sort of defy the normal rules of training them and campaigning them and conditioning them, and I think trainers have to take certain risks and run them in certain spots where they might not be absolutely 100% and circumstances aren't perfect for them, which is why horses who can mop up around the globe are so special. And I think that might have been the case the other night. The trainer's a lovely man. He doesn't speak that much English, as I found out to my cost, but he did manage to convey that he felt that this was very much the beginning of a building exercise through the season. So if she wasn't at her best, then there's a lot to look forward to. And you can see she's got all the mechanics just to be a really talented racehorse. She covers an awful lot of ground. She switches off nicely in a race now. They've got a hood on her. She quickens up smartly. She's versatile in terms of distance. Christophe Lemaire's ridden many great horses, says she's the best he's ever ridden. I'd love to see her with the hood off. I think these hoods, Kieran Fallon on the Sunday show, he was saying much the same thing. He thinks they're great for getting horses to relax early in their careers. But once they know how to race quite sweetly through a race, he thinks that it's not, not a brilliant idea, and they almost become too becalmed by them. And like I said, I don't think she was doing much when she hit the front. So I'd like to see them take the hood off her when she races, but that's a minor issue. It's a side issue.
Well, the rest of the activity, let's jump to the feature and talk about Thundersnow again, posted wide and did it differently this year, but just as outstanding. This is a unique accomplishment, and much like Justify last year, Nick, you get the sense that, you know, there's a certain percentage of people that want to anoint horses, and then there's others that, you know, put the achievement in context. And it does feel like Thundersnow carved out a unique accomplishment for himself, mm-hmm. and that he's really an outstanding international campaigner.
And of course, you can do both. The two things aren't mutually exclusive, and that's really well encapsulated by Thundersnow in this year's World Cup, because the bald facts are that his performance this year was nowhere near as dominant as it had been the previous year. But we need to factor in several points here. First is that last year he broke from the inside, he dominated the race, he raced on a track where there was a ridiculous bias, and everything fell in his lap, and he drew away to win pretty unflustered. This year, it was a completely different kettle of fish. He had a bad draw. He had a worse prep coming into the race. His connections were convinced that he wasn't really ready for it. He didn't match his three best performances from last season. He didn't match his run in the Breeders' Cup Classic. He didn't match his run in the Jockey Club Gold Cup. And he didn't match his win in the Dubai World Cup. But he was still good enough to beat what, by World Cup standards, was probably a pretty ragtag and bobtail bunch. Partly because there are a few horses in there who aren't world-class, and partly because the ones that are world-class, like Seeking the Soul, didn't really show up. So it might not have been a race that at that sort of level took the sort of winning that it should have done. But the fact that he was able to win two World Cups, the fact that he's been in so many insane battles and has had some pretty vigorous rides and has kept coming back for more, makes him a bit of a warrior of a horse. And he's got such an unusual profile. All the crazy stuff he's done in his career, you know, winning 10 furlong Group 1s as a 2-year-old on soft turf in France, winning a mile Group 1 in France as a 3-year-old, running creditable races in European classics, flunking out completely in that bizarre display in the Kentucky Derby, winning two Dubai World Cups, winning a UAE Derby, running some great races on the dirt in the US last year. I mean, he's an admirable horse, even if he's not a great horse in the pantheon of wild overachievers.
Well, this victory basically a capping of a remarkable evening for Godolphin, this time, although Appleby had won the first three, it was Saeed bin Sarur's turn, and that was kind of appropriate.
It was appropriate. It's significant for Saeed as well, because it's not been lost on anyone that Charlie Appleby's had the bulk of the good horses, and certainly had the bulk of the new exciting horses to train over the last couple of years, and the results have borne that out. Charlie is a very good trainer, there's no doubt about that, but similarly, he has had much the best of the Godolphin stock and has done extremely well with them. For Saeed, I think probably the most special of his World Cups, in a way. Clearly, he's had far more brilliant winners, Dubai Millennium and others who've won impressively. Moon Ballard springs to mind as one who won by a very long way. But he I don't think it would have garnered as much personal satisfaction from any of the other eight that went before the one on Saturday night.
Before we talk about the dirt races, let's get the two William Buick successes discussed. Old Persian in the Shima Classic, and Blue Point, who was denied his opportunity last year, and he showed probably what he would have done last year had he been able to run.
Yeah, and don't forget Cross Counter as well in the Dubai Gold Cup.
Yes, absolutely.
They were the Buick Appleby treble, and they're all interesting horses for Europe in the coming months. Quite often you get the odd horse that drops in on World Cup night that's just culminating a very good carnival season, and you don't really think he or she is going to go on and do it on the global stage during the course of the year. That's not the case about any of these three. They're very, very good horses. Old Persian ran an amazing time last year in the Voltigeur when he beat Cross Counter. He is a horse who I think Godolphin will have as one of their leading middle distance horses for this year. They've got Massar on the comeback trail as well, last year's Derby winner. I'd see Old Persian's first major target being something like the King George at Ascot after Royal Ascot, and then look to a back-end campaign with him. I'd have thought Cross Counter is going to go for all the distance races. He's now won the first leg of the Weatherby's Hamilton £1 million stayers bonus, so he could emulate Stradivarius and win that this year conceivably, but that's going to be a really exciting division in Britain this year. The extreme stayers, 2 miles plus, it could have Kew Gardens, Stradivarius and Cross Counter going up against each other. They'd be the most talented group of stayers we've probably seen in this country since the golden age of Le Mans and Ardross in the late 70s, early 80s, I would have thought. He's a smashing horse. It was great to see a Melbourne Cup winner come back. And Blue Point, I've never fully been convinced that he could be as good at six furlongs as he was at five furlongs at Royal Ascot last year, but now a bit more tractable. And William Buick's got him to settle. He sort of made a man of him, really. And he's a formidable sprinter, granted the right conditions. So they're exciting prospects.
Turn to the dirt races, and the first two opportunities for Jose Ortiz on this stage, they went pretty well. Todd Pletcher gets a international success and is his first win at Dubai, and Colfront, I thought, was a kind of an overlooked, you know, because it's a long night, seemingly a little bit overlooked in the wake of the activities, to go out and win that race, you know, capturing a loose leader, Nick, that was an accomplishment on that racetrack.
Yeah, I think there are several reasons why that was arguably the most creditable performance by a U.S. trained horse on the evening. Not to detract from Pluska Parfait and XY Jet's thoroughly deserved victory. But the thing about Colfront, he's a pretty unexposed horse. Low mileage horse. He's clearly not been that easy to train. And you definitely sense there's a sense of unfinished business with him. There hadn't been a North American trained winner of the Godolphin Mile since 2008. In addition to that, the talk before the race was all about Muntasar, and he couldn't be beaten, and there's a strong group of local horses. It's a race that sets up well, given the way the carnival program is run for horses that are trained locally. And I thought for him to come and do what he did was pretty creditable. Under a good ride as well, Jose Ortiz, just the mark of that world-class rider is that they can turn up to a new race course in a completely different part of the world, and they can be completely unfazed by it, completely unflustered, and ride it like they've been riding there all their lives. And that's what only the very best can do. That's what only the Moores and the Dettori's and the Moreras and the Pertons and the Hugh Bowmans and the Jose Ortiz can do.
Well, that set the stage up for what was going to then be an absolute bob and weave, the ride on Pluska Parfait for Brendan Walsh, who had spent time himself in Dubai as he developed his training CV. One of the really, you know, personally, and I've gotten to know Brendan very well, Nick, and I couldn't be happier for him. It was a really special moment.
Yeah, it was definitely a feeling of one for the good guys, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And again, we were lucky enough to have Brendan on the Sunday morning show to reflect on that. I think he recognized the significance of having a horse that, even if at this stage he wasn't one of the likeliest candidates to win the Kentucky Derby, at least deserved to go there as some sort of a player, and was a horse that would go there with a pretty decent chance of getting the distance as well, even if he fell short on class. And I think for someone who grafted pretty hard and worked their socks off to get where he's got, and results like that were pretty meaningful, and yeah, you couldn't fail to be delighted for him.
what did you make of the race overall? Because the initial reaction over here was that these are subpar three-year-olds, and here's points are being misused in the Derby point scheme. That he and Grey Magician, are ordinary or have been let's say second tier three-year-olds so far this year.
Well, that may very well be the case. And I suppose that it's going to be focused on rather more sharply in a year where you've got a seemingly very open Kentucky Derby. And given that's the case, there will be more people clamoring for their, what would normally be, no-hoper to get in as a lively outsider. So I suppose the margins in that sense may be a little finer. I think he's a good enough horse to line up in the race by average race standards, but you wouldn't give him much more than a 20-25-1 shot at the moment, would you?
No. But the fact that he comes back and is going to run on a track he's familiar with, and there are some elements here, and also we're kind of waiting for. For one of the other, au courant stars to reaffirm themselves, whether it's one of the Bafferts or whether it's Mandela or, whoever it's going to be.
Of course, the ultimate irony would be that if this year produced a stellar crop of three-year-olds when all was said and done, when at the moment we think they're all much of a muchness, perhaps it's simply the case that we haven't seen the primus inter pares yet. Or seen that horse show what he's capable of. Whereas, of course, at this time, the corresponding time 12 months ago, we were hailing the greatest crop of three-year-olds since the late 1970s, weren't we? And,
yes.
And look what we landed up with behind Justify, Audible and his pals.
Well, and we'll I do want to circle back to Audible and his pals in a second, but we'll see where these three-year-olds go. I don't know if Grey Magician is going to utilize his points or not, but we'll talk to Brendan tomorrow.
He'd want to be coming cutting back in distance. I would have thought, wouldn't you, Grey Magician? I think Peter Miller was of the view when I spoke to him after the race that just that last 100 yards did for him. He traveled and moved like the best horse in the race. Thought the winner got the best ride as well. I don't think anyone was any doubt about that. But he's a pretty honest broker, Pluska Parfait. And for the connections, I'd like to see him in Churchill Downs.
Well, and the local Imperial Racing, for them, a mammoth thrill. And so that part of the story also rather a nice epilogue for the plan to get to Carnival and to the World Cup opportunity. Finally, Jorge Navarro and third trip for this unbelievably hard-knocking sprinter. And he got a bit of a break when Promises Fulfilled did not get into stride quick enough to contend, but still he held everybody at bay and gets his elusive Golden Shaheen victory.
Yeah, his biggest break arguably was Roy H scratching for the race a couple of days before.
That too.
And that kind of left things open up beautifully for him. And there wasn't going to be quite the insane pace pressure that there was on him last year, which cost him the race on a speed favoring track. The only closer in 2018 was Mind Your Biscuit. But there was nothing in Mind Your Biscuit's class in this race either, you could argue, fundamentally. So it did set up nicely for him, and he on figures should have beaten Materia Sky roughly by the distance that he did. You could make a case that Imperial Hint was a shade below his very best, but he ran an honourable race. He's a smashing little horse. What was Ortiz supposed to have done on Imperial Hint? If he'd gone forward and really taken on XY Jet, would they have just set it up for Promises Fulfilled? I don't know. I think it was a reasonably representative result, and certainly it was a deserved victory for the winner.
Well, and as a seven-year-old, he can take the place of Ronaldo the Wizard now, and shake Ziad Road as returning to the desert year after year.
which I'm sure he will. I'm sure he will. Seven-year-old gelding, what's he going to be doing next year? He'll be back at Maidan running for another $1.6 million first prize or whatever it was.
It puts him over $3 million in earnings. And I said at the beginning of the show, Nick, you know, Navarro is a divisive figure in the U.S. and a bit of a lightning rod. And he's been, I think, last year's events thoroughly chastised him. And he certainly has been talking like somebody that understands the impression and the image that he was giving off, and his emotion with this horse, and really the job he's done to bring a horse back from 6 month and 13 month knee surgery layoffs and have him get back to his best races over and over again, it speaks to something. And people may think whatever they want, if you're doing things to take an edge with a horse, they don't stay formful for as long as this horse has and as long as Sharp Azteca did.
And again, I've been quite careful here, but those two things, again, are not mutually exclusive. There are many trainers who have skated quite close to the perimeter fence over the years. And when it's found out that might be the case, people assume that their achievements, therefore, are rendered insignificant. Well, it certainly leaves a tarnish on their career, and so it should. But that doesn't mean to say that they're not and haven't been inherently quite talented operators for all sorts of other perfectly valid reasons. So, just because someone has... as I say, pushed the boundaries or broken the rules, it doesn't necessarily mean that when they have been abiding by the rules, they haven't been able to do things that are evidence of significant talent. So I think I've phrased that diplomatically.
Absolutely.
Enough not to get you into any trouble.
No, I am. I've said this a while. You don't. Horses that have been inappropriately treated, they fall apart. They don't stay in form for campaign after campaign, and that's just a fact. So
if it was that easy, anybody could do it. If it was that easy, anybody could train a Kentucky Derby winner, or These things are never as black and white as they're presented.
Nick Luck with us. And Nick, a couple of things to kind of weave into this. You know, you did Luck on Sunday. You spent time with Brendan Walsh. You had Mike Smith. I haven't been able to watch anything except for the racing TV clips. They've got about a minute and a half clippings. But talk about the aftermath and your discussions. You also weighed in, I thought, quite appropriately about appeasement issue that we're facing here domestically regarding PETA and the situation at Santa Anita.
I had a feeling this would come up, so I hope that I don't upset too many people by what I'm going to say, but I think that it's a very depressing state of affairs on the West Coast at the moment. Very sad and depressing state of affairs, foremost because there are too many horses dying. That's the simple truth of it. There are too many horses dying, and there is no clear cause established for that sequence. It may be freakish, it may be a spike, but there is no clear cause established. It's quite right that the Stronach group react, and it's quite right that they react and attempt to show some leadership, because nobody else is showing any leadership, so they shouldn't be criticized for attempting to show leadership when there is no leadership being shown anywhere else. I don't have any issue with that at all. Where there is a significant problem, and I don't care whether this is in California or anywhere else, where there is a significant problem is that it's been decided in the rush to make racing appear better that everybody, whether they like the sport, don't like the sport, or are simply downright hostile to the continuation of the sport, should have some sort of say in how the sport is operated. Now, that, to me, doesn't make any sense at all. When you talk about strong leadership, it doesn't mean that you go to the person who dislikes the sport the most, or the group of people that actively wants to see the sport finished off forever, no matter where it is in the world, and say to them, do you approve of what we're doing? Is it all right by you? What reaction do you expect when an incident then takes place 5 days later, 6 days later? You've allowed people who are naturally hostile to what you're trying to do to have a voice in influencing the sport. And that cannot be. That cannot be right. You can debate whether it's right to medicate horses with Lasix on race day. I personally think that it would be right for the whole sport if there was one unified medication policy across the major racing jurisdictions in North America. Who doesn't genuinely believe that? And that there was a reduction, an eventual elimination of race day Lasix. That has to be right for the furtherance of the sport in North America. It has to be, in terms of the way that the global horsemen perceive of racing. I appreciate that. There is a debate to be had about how you regulate the use of the whip or the crop or the cushion crop. You can call it what you will, but this is a horse racing program. We're all grown-ups here. I think we know what it is and what it does. There is a grown-up debate to be had about that. Again, involving consistency of regulation and actually some active regulation so it doesn't get out of control. People should be acting responsibly when they're riding horses. But the minute you say, as a jurisdiction, for example, what we're going to do now, we think public perception doesn't like the look of horses being whipped, so we take that away. Well, do you think that public perception actually likes horses being raced? Can you justify the notion that hitting a horse in a race is crueler than racing a horse? Well, of course it's not. So you either allow some nebulous ethics to overtake your sport, or you regulate your sport properly from within with an independent regulatory body, and you say, this is our sport. This is the way we regulate it. We regulate it robustly. And it may well be that given it's 2019, we have to regulate it a damn sight more robustly than we did in 1959, 1909, or 1859. This is not an anti-progressive rant. But what we're not going to do is allow people who represent a very small percentage of the population, no matter what they claim, to start governing the internal ethics of the sport of horse racing. It is not the case that the majority of people believe that milking a cow is cruel. That is simply not the case. Yes, there is a shift in people's attitude to the way that animals and humans interact. But if you still subscribe to the view that there is a relationship between people and animals that is mutually beneficial, as I see it, then you can subscribe to the view that horse racing is a perfectly reasonable pursuit if it is properly and fairly regulated. And the idea that you could ignore the testimony of incredibly experienced practitioners and horsemen who've been ambassadors for the sport over years and years and years, you can ignore their testimony and brush it aside in favor of not even thinly veiled threats from what is not an animal rights organization, what is not an animal welfare organization, is an animal rights political campaigning lobby, then you may as well just watch the sport go to hell in a handcart. This is an absolutely pivotal moment. I don't blame the Stronach Group for what they're attempting to achieve, because their goal is an admirable one. But the way that the sense of panic that has set in going about achieving that goal has opened up a really, really dangerous situation. And that dangerous situation has got to have grave consequences for the future of Californian racing, unless somebody gets everyone by the scruff of the neck and says, come on now, let's accentuate the positives and stand up for the sport accept the fact that the sport has inherent risks, but convince everybody that we can take a really strong, unified regulatory approach to this and show everyone we've got decent, strong leadership and good inherent morals, for want of a better way of putting it. So rant over, Steve. Thanks very much. I've been bubbling that away for about 2 weeks now, and you give me the chance to say it.
Well, and nobody here has been able to say it as eloquently, and I can't tell you how appreciative I am. And particularly, you know, this is a subject that hits home with Aintree coming up and with the Grand National, where when there's been incidents in the Grand National where 8 or 9 horses straggle home from 35 starters, there's great outcries. And it's very timely.
But I registered declare my interest here. I'm a non-executive director of Aintree Racecourse, where they run a race over 4.5 miles over 5-foot obstacles, at 30 fences. And some of those fences have a slight drop on them. But I've seen it firsthand how the racecourse has taken ownership. The racecourse, in conjunction with the British Horse Racing Authority, and in conjunction with World Horse Welfare, and in conjunction with the Royal Society of Protection of Cruelty to Animals, genuine animal welfare groups, who will hold the sport to account, but will do so in a fair and balanced way, they have come together with the racecourse, the Jockey Club, and the British Horse Racing Authority, and show genuine leadership in enabling that race's survival. And they've done so by making adjustments to the racecourse to essentially make the sport safer, but without removing the essence of the challenge it poses to horse and rider. It is still 4.5 miles. It's still 30 fences. The fences are still 5 foot high, or 4 foot six high, 4 foot nine high minimum. So the essence of the challenge has not changed. But what has changed are the welfare measures pre and post race, the suitability of horses to run in the race. The race conditions have changed. The washdown methods have changed. The cool down methods have changed. The veterinary record checking has changed. The trot up procedures before the race have been altered. Not only that, the internal cause of all the fences have been changed. So if there is a faller or a horse does hit a fence halfway up, the material used to make the fences a load more forgiving. So you're reducing the chance of serious injury. You can now bypass a fence. So any horse that is receiving veterinary treatment can be gone round by the rest of the field. There are now pens to catch loose horses, so horses can't injure themselves if they come apart from their riders, or it's much less likely that they injure themselves. So if those measures hadn't been taken, and strong leadership hadn't been shown, and cooperation hadn't been shown, then the Grand National probably wouldn't exist now, or at least its future would be threatened in the same way that racing in California is now being threatened. And I can't see that. I'm not going to say I can't see the way back, but In dark moments, I'm struggling to see the way back.
Nick Luck, everybody. The most decorated presenter in the UK and respected worldwide for his love of the game and his delivery of it. And Nick, I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. And the only thing else we'll ask is, with declarations happening, who's winning the Grand National? Tiger Roll, Vintage Clouds.
I got to get my sense of humor back now. It is a fantastic race this year. It's probably it's the most intriguing one I can remember for a long time. The genuine possibility of the first back-to-back winner of the race since Red Rum in the 70s. That's just a fantastic book, and a tiny little horse as well. So that's sort of an appealing prospect. He's been given a chance as well. He's been given a theoretical chance by the handicapper. If the race was reassessed now, he'd be carrying more weight than he's due to. Tougher task than last year, but he arrives in the race in amazing form after that dominant display at Cheltenham. So he's got to have a great chance. You couldn't exactly back him at 7-2 in a race with those conditions, but so many exciting horses against him. Annabelle Fly, the Gold Cup runner-up, Ruth Vinden, who won at Cheltenham last year. he'd be high on the shortlist. From the home team at Lakeview Lad for Scotland, I think will run well. Vintage Clouds ran very well at Cheltenham. Horse who won over the fences in December, November, December, Walk in the Mill. He'd have to have a pretty good chance right down the bottom of the weights. It's a really competitive running, and I can't wait to get up there.
Look forward to it, as always. And Nick Gluck, everybody, you should be following, and just invaluable and just a reasoned voice. Nick, thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Take care.
Nick Gluck, folks. And there you go. 3 hours, as expected, in rapid fashion. And we'll come back tomorrow with a lot more recapping, including with Brendan Walsh. Andy Serling will join us ahead of Wood Memorial Day and much, much more. I've got quite a few of the winners from the weekend that we want to get to. And the California contingent. I might... Baltus, of course, with the two wins. I didn't even get you all of the recap type winners from Friday and Saturday and yesterday. But Baltus and Michael McCarthy, Ohio. How about Ohio winning the Killerow and more? Mark Glatt, happy for Mark Glatt, who wins the two stakes yesterday. So, including the graded stake. So maybe we'll get them live in person on Wednesday and Thursday from Clocker's Corner. You know, and with Joe Strummer rolling in, I'll put in a vote for Rock the Casbah. Rock the Casbah at Aintree for the Grand National this weekend, coming up on Saturday. How about, there you go, for Clash fans, right? I want to thank Ian Wilkes and Johnny D, Ben Glass, and Nick Luck. And Joe Land behind the glass. Tremendous. We are going to get the podcast loaded. Might take a little bit into the afternoon. We'll get Friday's show up, too. Sorry, that's not there. And back with you here tomorrow, Monday, or Tuesday. Thanks, everybody.